This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. 800 acres of the Clarksburg State Forest is gone. It's a wildfire, and it's the largest in Massachusetts in over two decades, since the Toccoa Mountain Fire in 1999. More than 100 firefighters across Massachusetts and Vermont continue to battle the fire, which has burned its way through Williamstown, Clarksburg, and North Adams since last Friday, when it started in a remote wooded area of Williamstown. We wanted to find out how unusual this fire is, how much it has to do with climate change, what it means for the health and safety of the communities in its wake. So joining us to give us an update is Dave Salino, Chief Fire Warden for the Department of Conservation and Recreation. Dave, thank you for joining us. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
So Dave, when I close my eyes, I don't even know what to imagine. I understand you've been to the site of the fire. Can you describe what a fire of this proportion is like?
Well, it's actually, it grew a little bit more. The acreage currently is 947 acres up there. And we'll tell you a little bit about where it is. It's located about 2 miles northeast of the center of Williamstown off of Route 2, the Route 2 corridor. And it actually sits right up on the ridge top where the Appalachian Trail leaves Route 2 and travels up across that hill country and links up with the Long Trail in southern Vermont. And it started Friday night, early evening, off of a road to the west of the ridgetop, and actually burned up slope into the Clarksburg State Forest area. The extent of it actually is burned about 85% of the footprint is in the Clarksburg State Forest. And it burned along the leaf litter. It's not a huge amount of damage, actually. It's the state forest is actually still there. And in the fire behavior, what we call the fire behavior is actually pretty typical of what we see in springtime wildland fire behavior, even here in New England.
So I want to unpack that a little bit, because my understanding is also that it's the biggest fire of this kind in over 20 years. You sound pretty calm about it, you know, pretty sanguine about it. So how do we square that circle?
Sure. It really, so you're correct. It's the largest fire that we've had since 1999. In 1999, we had an 1,100 acre fire over in Toccoa Mountain, just north of Westfield. It was actually in the town of Russell, on that big chunk of mountain that sits right next to the Massachusetts Turnpike. And, historically, you know, it seems significant that we would have another fire that was close to 1,000 acres. But when we look at history in Massachusetts and across the northeastern United States, it's actually not that uncommon. If we take a big snapshot in time going back even just 100 years, Massachusetts actually has a rich history in wildland fire. And it wasn't that long ago, up through even the 40s and 50s, 60s, and even the early 70s, it was not uncommon for us to have wildland fires that were in excess of a couple of hundred acres or even a couple of thousand acres. 1957 was a very famous fire in the town of Plymouth that burned 15,000 acres in just 12 hours. And the only thing that stopped it was that it burned to the shores of Cape Cod Bay, just south of the village of Plymouth.
What's different now? Yeah, so what's different now?
Well, so there's a lot of things that have changed. For one thing, our culture and how we fight fire. We actually, to date this year in 2021, we've already accounted for 589 wildland fires, although a lot of them have been small. And there's a couple of things that lead to that is changing weather patterns. We just haven't had those long duration droughts that maybe they had back then. And also technology, cell phones play a huge role in getting early detection. And our fire towers also play a huge role as well. We still run a fire tower network that helps us get early detection. And then equipment, you know, the equipment has really progressed over the years. It allows firefighters to make access to these remote fires a lot easier than it was, say, two generations ago.
So is everyone safe, Dave? The people who are fighting the fire, people in the communities, is there something that we should be watching or worried about? Or are we looking at the natural order of things? Do you understand my question?
I do, and that's a great question. I'm always pleased to hear that question asked, because what that means is we're focused on, first of all, the safety of our first responders. That's regardless of what the incident was, whether it's a house fire or you know, a wildland fire or a hurricane, whatever the response is, we're always first concerned about the safety and the risk to those first responders. They're the valuable commodity that we have in our communities, in our country, in our states. And so we look at that first and foremost, and then absolutely the what's the risk to the public. And so in a fire like this, although it was large in size, we were lucky that it actually burned into an area that is very remote. And there were what we call values at risk. There were no values at risk in terms of the downwind direction of how the fire was spreading. So as opposed to many other fires that we've had already this year in 2021, we can actually account for about 250 or 60 residential homes that we know were threatened. A number of them were damaged, and we've actually had over 90 outbuildings, other structures that were either damaged or destroyed by even some of those smaller wildland fires, because they happened in places we call the urban interface, where development comes into contact with those wildlands out there, whether it's forest or grasslands or shrubland.
So Dave, in this case, is there something ecologically beneficial to a fire like this, especially given that we know it is not posing as much of a threat, perhaps, as some in the past?
Yeah, you know, I love the connection to it. Is it a natural act? And it sure is. We know that fire has played a huge role in the makeup of our landscape and our ecosystems over millions of years. And so fire has a way of reintroducing itself, whether we like it or not, in certain circumstances. And there are a lot of ecosystems that actually are what we call fire dependent ecosystems. So a great example that sticks right out is the Pine Barrens down there in southeastern Massachusetts or New Jersey. The scrub oak Pine Barrens are a fire dependent ecosystem. Pitch pine actually is designed naturally over those thousands and thousands of years to become fire resistant. And there are just hundreds of plants and wildlife that depend on fire being part of that ecosystem at some point during its life cycle.
So is there a climate change dimension to this particular fire?
Yeah, you know, I would say that there is. We always, as fire managers, so one of those technology improvements we talked about was also recognizing and using new tools to our advantage to predict fire behavior and recognize when we're going to have these upticks in fire danger periods. And certainly we're looking at weather. Fire managers are now sort of hobbyist weather experts, and we're looking at weather all the time. There's three natural influences of wildland fire. It's first of all the weather, and then the fuel conditions, and then topography. And in the East Mountain fire, all three of those natural influences came together to line up and actually help the spread of this fire into the size that it was. So part of that is an influence from last year's drought. And this is the best analogy that I can make, and the connection I can make for your question is that the 2020 drought, we're still seeing effects in the fuels in the forest on fire behavior and fire conditions. And we're seeing those larger dead fuels that would have normally absorbed a lot of moisture over the winter they never really recovered from the drought that lasted all the way through to November of last year.
Well, Dave Cellino, Chief Fire Warden for the Department of Conservation and Recreation, we'll be thinking of you and the other firefighters still battling this fire. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. 11 days and counting until a new normal here in Massachusetts. That's when residents can return to all businesses and venues in the Commonwealth with no capacity restrictions and no masks in most cases. So what do these huge changes mean for businesses, residents, schools, you? What questions does it raise for you? It is Tuesday, and it is time to ask the doctors. Call with your coronavirus vaccine restrictions and spread questions. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now to take our questions and yours are Dr. David Sinhamer, an infectious diseases physician at Boston Medical Center, and a professor of infectious diseases and medicine at the Boston University School of Medicine, and a new doctor joining us today, Dr. Gabriela Andujar-Vasquez, an infectious disease physician, associate hospital epidemiologist, and medical director of the COVID-19 vaccination program at Tufts Medical Center. Dr. Hamer, welcome back.
Thank you.
Dr. Andujar-Vasquez, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
And again, listeners, that number is 800-423-8255. So, Dr. Hamer, I'm going to start with you with this question. Is this the right time, May 29th, to be lifting the last of our restrictions and going with CDC mask guidance instead of our own statewide mask mandate?
That's a tough question, Tiziana. I mean, many of the indicators for sort of evidence of COVID-19 transmission in the state have been steadily improving in the last 4 to 6 weeks with, fewer cases each week, lower positivity rates. There's reductions in the wastewater. The level of contamination of the virus in the wastewater. So, I mean, a lot of indicators are all good, but there's still a fair amount of virus circulating, and there's been evidence of introduction and spread of B.1.1.7, the UK variant of concern, and now even more recently, some very preliminary evidence that B.1.6.1.7.2, the Indian variant of concern, has reached Massachusetts. So these are both thought to be potentially more transmissible viruses. So it's a time where we need to have a lot of caution. So I'm a little concerned that it may be early, but on the other hand, all the evidence, I think, from vaccinations suggests that we're moving in the right direction, so it may all work out okay.
So I'm going to stay with you for just a second, hearing you say that expresses a level of concern that we didn't hear from Dr. Rochelle Walensky at the CDC. How does the average person who wants to trust all our public health physicians deal with that tension? What do you want people to think?
I think we can get into some of the, more nitty gritty about what is safe to do, what's not safe to do. And I think the CDC is feeling relatively comfortable with the direction that many states have gone in terms of the degree of transmission and the impact of vaccination, which I have to say, a lot of this really is, well, there's probably a seasonality to it, but a lot of this, that is with spring, summer having reduced transmission, or at least being associated with reduced transmission in the Northeast. But a lot of it has to do with vaccination. And I think many states have done very well with vaccination, but not all. So that gives me some pause for concern. And there's still evidence that there's transmission even to people who've been vaccinated. It's very, very low risk, but it can happen. And other parts of the world where rates of disease are at the levels that we're still seeing have remained closed down. They've been much more cautious in terms of reopening. So, I think the CDC's probably been under pressure to try and get the economy fully active again, have people return to sort of their usual state of work. But the question is, are we doing this too early?
So, Dr. Andujar-Vasquez, where do you stand on this in this moment? Are you feeling like pretty much the right call, right time? Are you feeling like right call, but maybe too soon? Wrong call?
I think that we've been, trying to be all this time throughout the pandemic very cautious about some of the decisions around, public health, because we know the how important, you know, it is to make the right decision and how sometimes uncertainty can play a big role in it. And I think that if you go by the case numbers and the in Massachusetts, right, and I think in the nation, and then the number, and particularly in Massachusetts, the number of vaccinations that we've had so far, from now until all the COVID-19 mandates will be lifted in May 29, I think it's probably the right decision. It feels like it's too fast. It feels like it may be too early, but I do believe that it's probably the right decision based now that after a year of dealing with this pandemic, we have the tools in our hands to reduce the risk as much as we can of contracting this virus. That being
so, go ahead, finish your thought. Sorry, I just didn't know you weren't done.
No, that's okay. And by that I mean, you know we have a safe and effective vaccine, but then we know we worried about those people that may not be able to get vaccinated and the immunocompromised and whatnot. But we also have the tools to avoid that by masking, say social distance. We still can wear a mask, you know. So we can talk a little bit more about how that risk, personal risk, may be taken depending on your, you know, your environment, right, and your medical conditions. But I think it's probably the time to do it now that we're entering to the summer and the number of cases we have in the state.
So I have many more questions, but our callers have even more than that. The lines are full already, so I want to get to some. And again, you will be able to get through once I take one of these calls. So the number is 800-423-8255. We've got Janet on Cape Ann. Janet, go ahead.
Thank you for the call. My question is regarding my husband, who is in his mid-70s, who has diabetes type 2 and hypertension, is fully vaccinated, but is concerned about the fact that there will be a number of tourists coming to the area, going in and out of stores, in and out of here, there, wherever. What should we do to be careful?
Great question, Janet. Dr. Hamer, can I give that one to you?
Sure. So thanks, Janet. That's a good question, an important question. I mean, this gets at what I was, you know, think we should get into in a little more detail is that you know, if people are coming from out of state, out of country, you know, the level of transmission or the degree of transmission of SARS-CoV-2 is going to vary in different places, and many states are not as far along as Massachusetts is in vaccinating their population, and partly that's because people are refusing to be vaccinated. So that means there's going to be, you know, potentially some states that may have greater degrees of transmission, and certainly people coming from outside of the United States could be infected. So I think, you know, being in public places during the summer, you know, if you're outdoors where there's good air exchange, I think being maskless if you're vaccinated is fine. I think it's really when you start to get into public places indoors where there, you know, maybe, you know, less ventilation or there may be air conditioning with air being recirculated, then in that setting, probably wearing a mask still is a good idea. Like in a supermarket or a store or a, you know, restaurant, if you're indoors and not eating. So I think you're going to have to sort of, your husband and you should really be cautious in certain public places. And certainly, I think the CDC guidance is that any form of public transportation or waiting area, like an airport or a bus station or a train station, all those are places where mask use should continue.
So let's grab a couple calls here that are similar. 800-423-8255 is the number. We'll go to Beth in Framingham. Hi, Beth. What's your question?
Yes, hi. Thanks so much for taking my call. My question is about our household is mixed generation, three generations, and we're also because of that mixed vaccine status. So my mom, my husband, myself, and our 17-year-old are all fully vaxxed. But I have a almost 9-year-old who won't be able to get vaxxed for the foreseeable future. So I'm just wondering what advice you all have for folks like us who are going out with this mix of vaccine status.
And thank you for that call, Beth. I think we've got a similar question from Stacy in Sherburne. So Stacy, jump in your question as well.
So my question is similar. I have a child who is not yet old enough to be vaccinated, and I was wondering whether it is safe for him to go inside with adults not wearing masks, even if he has one on.
Okay, so there are the questions. Dr. Andujar Vasquez, can you help us with those?
Sure. So this at this point, we're in this point where we have to make decisions within our own family household on what risk we feel comfortable, right, taking. And it's certainly now that, you know, the mask mandates have changed, we do have to take into consideration the patient, the people that are not able to get vaccinated, like the examples we just got provided by our callers. You know, if someone is, or by the first caller that did point out that they have an immunocompromised, a weakened immune system family member that may have not responded to that vaccine as well. And then the people like children that cannot get vaccinated. And, you know, it depends on the level of risk of that particular individual. So if they have medical conditions in regards to the children that may put them at risk to have severe disease with COVID, then I would recommend to continue doing, mask when you are around other people that you're not sure of their vaccine status, right? When you're in the public, indoors, not necessarily outdoors, but indoors, you can wear that mask if that child is unvaccinated. But now we do know that in children, the level of infection and severe illness is way lower than in adults, so, which is fortunate. And which is why when we have unvaccinated children, it's less likely that we will encounter them to have, you know, a severe illness, even if they're around other people that are not completely vaccinated.
So on balance, do you recommend the masking for the children on balance? I think that's what I hear you saying.
Right. So, right. If they feel like indoors, it depends on the scenario. If they're feeling indoors, they're unvaccinated, and they're around people that they're not sure that are vaccinated, they can certainly continue to wear masks.
Thank you.
So, and social distancing.
And that's an important point, right? We've sort of focused on the masking, but there is still the social distancing question as well. That's an important point. Dr. Hamer, go ahead.
Just a quick comment, which is, you know, I think that Dr. Andujar, her statement is, you know, really focused on indoors, and I agree with that. I think outdoors, you know, there's so little evidence of transmission outside if there's, you know, some degree of social distancing, just natural air currents. That you know, the need to wear a mask outside, unless you're really in close quarters for an extended period of time with a range of people, some of whom may not be vaccinated. I think otherwise, you know, outdoors, things are a lot safer.
I'm going to go back to the phones in just a minute, so let me put the number out, 1-800-423-8255, to join the conversation. We have a couple of lines open, and we should be able to get to your question. But before we do, I want to come back to the two of you. Either of you can answer this. At this point, what does the data tell us about your likelihood of getting, percentage-wise, of getting a breakthrough case of the coronavirus if you are fully vaccinated and have exited the 2-week time window after your last shot? Maybe Dr. Andujar Vasquez, are you able to answer that for us?
Yeah, I don't know a percentage, to be honest. But I do know that we have observed a number of cases of people are fully vaccinated and asymptomatic, whether it's asymptomatic screening or mild symptoms, they get tested and have been positive after being fully vaccinated. The majority of these cases have been people that are, like I said, asymptomatic, no symptoms, or mildly ill. And some proportion, which are the minority, have been ill across the state. I don't know a percentage at the top of my head right now. It's been absurd, but the vaccine has been doing its job in terms that people have been fully vaccinated and subsequently been tested for COVID are not sick.
And I understand I can, you know, I can ask you guys, hey, tell me the number on this. And you may not always have it off the top of your head. That is helpful. So then the follow-up question to you, Dr. Hamer, is are folks with those with asymptomatic screening, for example, who test positive as a breakthrough case, like Dr. Andujar Vasquez just told us about, are they in fact less likely to transmit, or are they as contagious as someone who has not been vaccinated? What does the data tell us?
So the data are relatively limited at this point in time, but at least some of the evidence that's accumulating suggests that they are asymptomatic, as Dr. Andujar Vasquez said, and that they also appear to have a lower viral load, which means they're presumably less able to transmit, less infectious, and it doesn't last that long. Now, not everyone. I mean, some patients are breaking through symptomatic infections with relatively high viral loads, but I think they're a minority relative to those that are becoming infected and having a sort of a transient brief shedding of virus, which is at low levels and suggests a greatly reduced risk of transmission. But again, we need more evidence on this to understand, you know, the risk of that of transmission from someone like that.
Back to the phones, 1-800-423-8255 to ask the doctors your question about vaccines, transmission, symptoms and illness, safety with masks, risk calculus, all of it. We've got Lisa on the line in Sandwich. Lisa, go ahead.
Hi. Hello, everyone. Thank you for all your support throughout the pandemic. I have a son who's now 3 years old, but he was born 6 weeks premature and did do a lengthy NICU time. And he cannot wear a mask. He is a respiratory specialist, and he can't wear one. But he also is immune compromised, and he is open to all vaccines. The pneumococcal vaccine doesn't work, and he can't even take the flu vaccine. He gets so sick. So I'm very nervous about him going to school with teachers who might not be masked in the future if they don't vaccine. But I'm also worried about him getting the vaccine with such a small infant pool of healthy children that they've been sampling. What's your advice?
So there's a lot there, Lisa. And what I think I'd like to do is break it into two pieces. So let's begin, Dr. Andujar Vasquez, with his risks in classroom environments if there are other people who are not verified as having been vaccinated and may not be wearing masks. Now, before you do that, let me just make it clear that the CDC guidance does continue to require masks in schools, and the Commonwealth is going to be asking people to comply with the CDC guidance after May 29th. Sorry about that. Dr. Andujar Vasquez, please go ahead.
Yeah, no, thank you for clarifying that. That is true and correct. The childcare and schools do require still masks. So in that sense, that's one level of protection, right? Even if you're not sure that the caretaker or school employer does have vaccine status, they do require them to wear a mask regardless of that vaccine status of that individual. So that protects your child. I understand completely your concern. There's a lot, just not only because of the age and the fact that because of that age, your child is not able to wear a mask, and also because of immunocompromised, weakened immune system. But I would say it's basically trying to make sure that you keep doing what you've been doing to keep him protected, despite the fact of all the things that you mentioned, right? I know that there may be encounters where we'll have unvaccinated people that may not choose to wear a mask, even though they should. And we should try to balance, you know, how much we want to interact with, you know, with individuals like that, depending on the scenario. Again, in school, at least, they are mandated still to wear a mask. So in that sense, the child is safe.
So part two of it then, Dr. Hamer, you know, Lisa's son is three. Right now, the authorization for emergency use of the Pfizer vaccine goes to children as low as the age of 12. We heard on our Ask the Doctors last week some anticipation that there are studies being done to try to, you know, lower that age further for, you know, seek authorization later. We do know there's smaller numbers in these pools of studies. Is it on the horizon that we might see authorization for younger kids, and are you comfortable with the size of the populations that it's being tested on as those decisions are getting made?
So, I mean, the answer to the first question is, I mean, absolutely. There are a couple different companies that are looking at children, I think, all the way down to 6 months, perhaps in one case, and certainly, you know, 1 year to 12 years or 1 year to 11 years to fill in that gap. And my anticipation is that the vaccine will be very immunogenic, that there'll be a very strong immune response in young children, as they showed with 12 to 15-year-olds. How the size of the studies, I haven't looked at that. The size of the study that they had for the 12 to 15-year-olds in the Pfizer study was relatively small. I mean, it was only maybe a tenth or a fifth of the size, roughly, of the, you know, pivotal phase 3 trials that were used for adults. And yet they had enough episodes of COVID-19 occur that they had sufficiently large sample size to show an effect. And so I suspect that these are being done with smaller numbers, and they you know, the question is going to be, will they be able to show efficacy? I think they will be able to show how safe they are and how well they induce an immune response. And that may be enough, although we don't necessarily have a clear understanding of how the immune response relates to protection. I mean, we're learning a lot more about that. It's a little hard to say if the studies are large enough, but I think that a lot of thought's gone into their design and that they should lead to sufficient evidence to allow for the use of these vaccines in younger children.
Let's try to grab one more call here. We've got Leslie on the line in Wayland. Leslie, go ahead.
Hi. I am wondering if you guys could give me like an elevator pitch that I can use with friends and coworkers who still have not decided to get vaccinated. I feel like I try up, down, and sideways to use data that I know to convince them that it's safe and effective. But I'm just, I feel at a loss. And so I'm wondering what would sort of like 2-3 data points, facts, whatever you can give me to help people feel comfortable and ready to get this vaccine that really is a data-driven tool to combat this virus.
Thanks, Leslie. So Dr. Andujar Vasquez, 2-3 pieces of data that are convincing that this is why you should get vaccinated.
Yeah, that's a great question. I hope I hope I can answer it as concise, but I think that, most of the time, the number one is I want to wait to see what happens. So usually I ask people to think about what's their threshold. You know, what is your number? What is the number of people after millions and millions of Americans are already vaccinated that has that probably the safe and effective vaccine and that has shown to be already real world data that it's safe and that it's 94 or more 90 to 94% effective, right, in healthcare workers, which is the bulk of the data that we've been showing, that CDC has been reporting out, in pregnancy as well, already supported by multiple, you know, medical and professional societies. What is your threshold to decide? Because most of the time, people just want to see how other family members or friends that have received the vaccine or have not, would react if they were to receive the vaccine. And what's that number? Because you give them, you know, the number of whether in your community. It sometimes it helps if you can tell them, you know, for us here at Tufts, I tell how many employees have been vaccinated, and that helps.
And how many is that?
Into context.
How many is that?
Oh,
do you know?
Had. Yeah, about 80, about more than 80% of our employees have had been vaccinated. And so within, depending on the department that I'm talking to, usually I tell them, you know, most of your co-workers have been vaccinated. I have asked them how they've been feeling after the vaccine. Things like that, to relate it to something that's palpable, right? To relate it to something that that helps them understand and relate to within their community. Because if they hear that, you know, millions of Americans have gotten vaccinated, they may not relate to that number, even though it's a big number. But if within their community, they do see, and then you see that people do well and are living their lives and now are able to, you know, take the mask off indoors and outdoors because we feel that they're safe. That makes, I think, a compelling case and helps, I think, people make their own decisions. Sometimes the reason for not getting a vaccine is very personal. it needs, you know, that one-to-one conversation.
Thank you for that. And quickly before we go, Dr. Hamer, I just want to give you a swing at it too. Any other data you would add to Dr. Andujar Vasquez's case there?
I mean, I think she's made several great points. I mean, I think, you know, one is at this point, I think it's probably, you know, if you include the UK, Israel, other parts of the world, there are now hundreds of millions of doses that have been administered, you know, especially of the messenger RNA vaccines with no evidence of, you know, medium or long-term safety concerns. They're highly effective at preventing symptomatic infection. They're even more effective, close to 100% effective in preventing severe disease and hospitalization. And they allow you to return to a more normal state of life.
All right. Dr. Davidson Hamer is an infectious disease physician at Boston Medical Center. Dr. Gabriela Andujar Vasquez is an infectious disease physician at Tufts Medical Center. Thanks to both of you for joining us. It was great to have you.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Our relationship with technology has changed in some fundamental way as a result of the pandemic. And at the same time, technology itself has altered how we engage with each other. So maybe you never Zoomed your parents before 2020, for example. And in fact, Zoom may not have been a verb for you before 2020. Now, Sherry Turkle is a professor at MIT and has spent her career exploring our relationship with technology and how technology affects our relationships. And we wanted to have her on today because her latest book plumbs the depths of her own personal and childhood relationships for how they shape her now. It's a courageous exploration, and we wanted to invite her to challenge us to consider our relationships and the role technology plays in them with the same level of probing insight that she turned on herself. Again, Sherry Turkle's book is The Empathy Diaries, a memoir. She joins us now. Sherry Turkle, welcome back to Radio Boston.
I'm delighted to be here.
So this book is different than books you've written in the past about our relationship with technology. Really bring in your own story. And it turns out that your early life has a lot of connection to what you wound up doing at MIT. Many of the people in your life, the experiences you had, kind of paved the way for this focus on empathy and ethics. Did you know that? So you set out to write the book to tell that story, or did you set out to tell your story and went, oh my God, it programmed me?
Well, you know, I think the truth, as is always the case when you write something, the truth lies in between. I knew that I had a story to tell about how I didn't have empathy shown me as a child. And so that gave me a lifelong interest in how important it was. And I really wanted to tell that story because the quest for empathy and a concern with how empathy can be undermined by technology is clearly, you know, my work is lit by that concern. And that comes out of understanding what it was like to be deprived of empathy as a child. Briefly, for your readers who may not have read the book, for your listeners who may not have read the book, my mother divorced when I was very young, and I wasn't allowed to say that I had the father I had. I wasn't allowed to use my real name. I had to hide the papers from school and pretend I had a different name than my real one. My name was Sherry Zimmerman, but I had to hide everything that had that name on it and pretend I was Sherry Turkle. So
even, you know, to your own half brother and sister.
Yes, from everybody. So I really lived a life of a kind of undercover spy. I had to do two things. I had to, on the one hand, try to figure out, like a Nancy Drew of my own life. The cover of the book shows me in a roadster that I always thought of as Nancy Drew's roadster that she used to go on her mysteries on. Why to try to be empathic with the people in my life and figure out why were they doing this to me? I mean, it was so odd. It was so odd. And on the other hand, I had to show them, I had to understand so young what it is to not be shown empathy. So it worked in both of those ways. So I understood when I started, to get back to your question, that empathy was so important. And yet, as I wrote the book, I made discovery after discovery, including this discovery of who my father was, that really nailed it down, that I was meant to study what I was studying.
Yeah, and I specifically want to bring that forward, because you heard me say at the top, part of what we want to do is have you help us challenge ourselves to examine, to examine our own pools of empathy and experiences with empathy. And I think people will understand the depth of exploration we're talking about if you tell us about meeting your biological father and what you discovered when you met him.
Yes. Well, I knew nothing about him, basically, consciously. But of course, a child hears things and then doesn't remember those things. And when I finally, my mother died, I had promised her to never find my biological father, to never seek him out. And then finally, it was very funny. When I wrote my first book, that kind of, you know, hit, it was called The Second Self, and I was Computers and the Human Spirit in 1984. And I was interviewed by Esquire magazine for being, I don't know, one of the 40 people under 40 who were changing the nation or something. And he said to me, "So tell me a little bit about your father." And my brand at the time, I guess still, was that thought and feeling are one. There's no distinct, you know, thinking is feeling. We love the objects we think with. We think with the objects we love. And I said to him, "Well, you can't ask me about my personal life. That's not possible. That's completely, you know, inappropriate." And he said to me, "Lady, your whole brand is that you're supposed to talk about, you know, why you're doing what you're doing." And I said to him, "You're right." And he made fun of me in the magazine. And as I watched him leave, I said, "You know, this has to stop now." And that's really when I started writing the book and decided that I would seek out my biological father, that I could not continue to honor my mother's secret. And it turned out that my biological father was a kind of rogue scientist who lived in Queens and who thought he had disproved Einstein. Because when I went to see him and knocked on the door, he said to me, "Did you find me through the New York Times?" And I said to him, "No, I found you by spending my salary on 2 years of detectives." And he had advertised in the New York Times, E equals MC squared is not correct. Queens high school teacher disproves Einstein. And that's how he thought I had found him. So,
and then you discovered that he'd been experimenting on you.
Yes. And And so that's who daddy, that's who my father was. But more darkly, I mean, that's the sort of funny part, but more darkly, I found out the reason my mother had left him was that when I was a baby, he had been doing kind of Skinner-like experiments on me. And he was quite relaxed about explaining this to me. He would, you know, put me in a room that was all dark for a while and see how I responded. He would not speak to me for a while and see how I responded. Essentially deprivation experiments of different sorts. And my mother caught him at them, and she packed up her bags, and she put some things in. Actually, she didn't have bags. She didn't have luggage. She packed up some things in A&P bags and some diapers and a few pieces of clothes. And she went back to live with her mother and father, my grandparents. And that's why she fled him. She was trying to protect me. That's why she didn't let me see him. So really, to get back to your original question, in the course of doing the book, I discovered a deeper connection to my mother. I had been angry at her all my life, really, for keeping my father from me. And in the course of doing this book, I reconciled with her. I developed an empathic connection with her. I more than forgave her. I connected with her, and I developed a new kind of compassion for myself, I think. So it was a very life-changing experience.
So let's pick it up there. You know, you had been incisive about relationships between people, how technology affects them, how it affects our perceptions. You then go through this odyssey, this journey of discovery, and you learned what kinds of tough questions you had to ask. You know, we are coming out of a time when we have been mediated by technology, probably yes. certainly unlike any time in my personhood. What are the questions, the hard, incisive questions we need to be asking ourselves now as we emerge?
Well, I think actually we're at a point of inflection because we have been sated with technology. I mean, we have been staring at screens now for a year. And I think now we're ready to ask, are we ready to return to the full embrace of the human? You know, are we ready to have a more mature relationship with this technology? Because we've been in a kind of love affair with technology where we've given so much away to it. You know, we have privacy, take it, you know, it's more convenient not to have it. Alexa, privacy, you know, I'll let it overhear my conversations because it will be more convenient. Online learning, it's convenient. And I think that now, you know, having had so much, we're in a position to take a much cooler look at the kind of human equation and say, for example, with parents, when offered a program that will monitor their child's learning, I'm finding in my studies now that parents are saying a program that's perfectly designed for my child, that will monitor his learning, that will be perfect for my child. No, you give my child a person. My child needs someone to talk to. I don't want another screen. So I think that you know there's a theme in my book of that I you know I call stepping out and stepping away from your reality in order to see it more clearly, which is how I describe my childhood, where I was forced to be marginal to my own reality because I wasn't even allowed to use my real name. That gave me a kind of insight into what was going on. And I think we can do this now as Americans, to sort of step out of the technological life that we've been living and say, how can we make this technology serve us? Have we given too much away in terms of privacy, in terms of manipulation of our politics? And how can we, you know, exert control as consumers and get some of this back?
And the book is The Empathy Diaries, a memoir. That is Sherry Turkle, MIT professor and author of that memoir. Sherry, thank you so much for sharing your wisdom. Appreciate you joining us today. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Walter Wuthman, with help from Stephen Gelman and Hafsa Qureshi. Our engineer is Marquise Neal. Executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.